Rebel Author Podcast, where we talk about books, business, and occasionally bad words.
Hello, Rebels. Welcome to episode 240 of the Rebel Author Podcast.
Today, I'm talking to Bianca Blythe all about how to write historical fiction. So the comments just won this week from Matt, and Matt says, "What a great, informative, fun, positive episode. This was Dharma's episode on how to write trans characters. It was really good to hear you both elaborate on such sensitive topics with such grace and good humour. Thank you." And thank you for the comments. Don't forget to leave your comments. I do love reading them, and I do love reading them out for everybody to hear as well. So, in personal news and updates, well, I think I'm skirting exhaustion again. So I haven't had an evening off for quite a long time. Last night was my first one. And to be perfectly honest, it wasn't a very good evening off because I was pretty much comatose and just zombieing, scrolling, which I shouldn't have done. I should have read. But, you know, when you have burnt the candle a little bit too low, that was me. Why have I been working so much? Well, I have learnt, because everybody drink, my strengths coach told me that significance and achiever don't like feeling like we owe people stuff. So this is a real lesson learnt for the Kickstarter. Lots of people who run Kickstarters have very long fulfillment periods, but I don't really work like that. And I obviously owed six people, whatever it was, annotated copies. And I dramatically underestimated how long that would take. It was taking upwards of 6 to 7 hours per book to do them. And so that has taken me several weeks to get them done, because obviously by the time you've put the kid to bed, by the time you've cleaned up after dinner, by the time you've sorted the pets out and all the rest of it, you know, it's already 8 o'clock. So I'm getting like a couple of hours off in the evening only to spend those working. So it's taken me a number of weeks to get these done. And because of significance and achiever, I can't rest until I know that whatever it is that I owe people is finished. So that is a real lesson learned for me in terms of my own personal psychology. And also, I will take that to my therapist, but also for me in terms of how I structure a Kickstarter. So I think this next one will be very much product based, very much the fulfillment day will be it. I won't be doing anything that is required after the fact. So I don't know what that's going to look like, but I'm definitely going to do some research or ask my one of my assistants to help do research on that, so that I can make sure that the consequence of a Kickstarter or a big project like that, which is fun, doesn't turn negative at the end when I'm then exhausted. And nobody could have predicted it. I didn't know. It's one of these things. We live and learn, right? We learn more about ourselves as we grow. The more experiments we run, the more we work out what does and doesn't work for us. So I love annotating books. You guys know that. I basically wrote a book on how to annotate books because I love it so much. But obviously, I don't know. Anyway, I'm just going to move on. So I have now finished. The Kickstarter books have gone to the book vault, and they are going to be shipping them. And that is it. I am done and dusted on Kickstarter numero uno, which is why I'm now looking to the second one. I am also trying to write. I'm about 25K into book two. And another thing that I have learnt about myself is that it's these people-pleasing tendencies, right? My significance, in fact, my yellow influencing strengths really love people. We love to make people happy. One of my greatest joys is knowing that I've made somebody laugh, or knowing that I've made somebody smile or cry even, but in a positive way, you know, like end of a book way, rather than like I've punched you and you're crying. I love to influence people positively. The consequence of that, with my increasing sales and income and kind of reach with the fiction, is that there are a lot more people messaging me and commenting and sliding into my DMs. All positive, definitely not saying anything negative about this. I want this. I love this. This is what I've been working towards. But the psychology of that is, because I am yellow dominant influencing strengths, it means other people have the power to influence me. And seeing the overwhelming swell of readers screaming at me, essentially, for book two, and all very kindly giving me their thoughts and opinions on book one and where they think book two is going to go, has obviously gotten into my head and has moved me away from what I think I should be writing into a sort of mindset of, oh, I need to write this book for them. Now, it's this really strange balance where we want to deliver to market, but delivering to market is not necessarily the same thing as trying to give readers exactly what they're screaming for, right? Readers don't understand the market. They don't come at publishing from a market angle. They come at it from a reader angle. And that is not the same thing. And the reason I know that that's not the same thing is because I wrote book one and it's delivered what they want, right? So the logic of that means that I need to only listen to myself and write book two the way that I want to write book two. The caveat to that is that I mean write book two, still deliver it to market, but what I understand as market expectations, rather than listening to readers who are like, oh, I think this is the bad guy, or oh, I think this is going to happen, or oh, I'm hoping this happens, or oh, I really want to see this happen. You know, those thoughts tend to get in my head, and because I want to make people happy, the plot veers away from what it should, what I think it should be, or, you know, what I think story structure wise would be a good twist or a good, anyway. So I have written 25,000 words and I'm actually going to stop this morning. Well, I'm going to go to the gym. And then after I come back from the gym, I'm going to just review the outline. And I'm going to make sure that the story is doing what I think it should be doing. My coach kind of gave me permission to do that and to just go, okay, fine. You know, you may lose some words and you may have a little delay, but ultimately you want to deliver the book that you want to deliver. So yeah, it's been a week of thinky thoughts and realizing that perhaps I may have veered off what I should have been doing. I don't really know if I have. I've been saying to my strengths coach all week, whining basically in a daily email whine, that the story doesn't feel right. There's something wrong. And I genuinely think it's because I've got too many voices in my head and I just need to shut everybody out. Hello, self-assurance. And just go with my inner knowing and my inner gut. That's the self-assurance. Self-assurance is not the same thing as confidence. It's an inner knowing and a kind of driving anchor that tells you that you know that you are going in the right direction. And that's what I need to listen to rather than anything else. So yeah, I think today might be a stop and pause day. I've also got an obscene amount of admin that has built up that I need to handle. And some other exciting things in the works, which I don't think I can talk about yet. I'm sorry. Such a dick tease. You love it. Don't lie. Okay, so other exciting thing is that I have now paid for half of New Zealand. I'm going to pay for the rest next week. And so our deposit's down. All the flights are done. All of the accommodation, the car rental. We have an initial itinerary. We are going to be doing all of the things. I'm so bloody excited. It's unbelievable. And yeah, so we've got things like whale watching, dolphin encounters, night gaze, stargazing experiences. Spring geyser things. I don't know how to pronounce the word. We're going to see an indigenous event or experience, I think it's called. We're going to literally do all of the things. Oh, Hobbiton. Yeah, anything that you can think of that is typical. The glowworm caves. Yeah, we're just going to do all of the things. And I don't think I've ever been more excited in my entire life for a trip. The other thing that I want to do whilst we're away is do like a travel journal. Does anybody have any tips or advice or like good websites or resources? So like I've got a notebook that I will take, but like how can I efficiently take like pretty things to make the journal pretty? without it taking up like an entire suitcase of stationery. If anyone has any tips or advice, that would be great. Thanks. I'm also thinking about doing an online kind of blogging the journey. I don't know. I think I probably won't end up doing that just because I'll be doing it sort of handwriting, and so I won't want to double up. But if anybody knows any cool like websites where you can do that, that it's sort of like pre-set up for you, do let me know, because otherwise I'm probably just going to chuck everything up on Instagram, I should have thought. Okay, enough of me bollocksing on. Right, the Rebel of the Week this week is Josh Gentry. Josh says, I went to high school in the United States in the 80s, and one of the things that happened here then was the Satanism scare. The good people of small town America became convinced that Satanists were everywhere. One of the symptoms of this was that many adults believed that heavy metal bands were tools of Satan. The metalheads in our school endured a veritable witch hunt. They would draw the symbols of their favourite bands all over their notebooks, and the principal started hauling them into his office, confiscating the notebooks, oh my goodness me, making them tear off the cover of their notebooks, etc., and interrogating them about the meaning of these symbols. My friends and I were not in that group, but we thought it was ridiculous, so we decided to start our own cult. It was the cult of Fertilesworth. And we had a stuffed cow in one of our lockers that was the idol we worshipped. We would drop notes in the hallway in front of the principal's office that said things like, meet you in the cemetery at midnight, I'll bring the knife, hail Fertilesworth. You can imagine our delight when the principal started hauling the usual suspects into his office and questioning them about our notes. One of our teacher friends that we had let in on the joke told us, he even brought the note to a staff meeting to discuss this dire threat to the school students. This is still the funniest thing I have ever been involved in. Oh, dear. Josh also has a book about a rebel called Bad Penny. She seduces vampires into biting her because she loves it, and then she kills them. Oh my goodness me, that's hilarious. Also, vampires. I might have to go and read that. Okay, amazing. Thank you so much for this rebel story. If you would like to be a Rebel of the Week, please do send in your story. It can be any kind of rebellion, something big, something small, or something in between. You can email your Rebel story to Becca over on rebelauthorpodcast@gmail.com. This episode is sponsored by Pro Writing Aid. Rather than me tell you all about why I love them, I'm going to let Shane, one of my patrons and also fellow author S.W. Miller, tell you all about why they like Pro Writing Aid and why they use it all of the time.
I use Pro Writing Aid to clean up my manuscripts before they go to my editor. Pro Writing Aid's great because it's not just a grammar checker. It teaches you how to improve your writing. It has reports for all those tricky areas authors hate, like style, passive voice, glue words, my own arch nemesis, cliches, and more. I've got high competition in my top 5 Clifton strengths, so the scoring feature really pushes me to improve my writing, because, of course, I want to beat the system. For me, the best thing is the way it integrates with Scrivener. I make all my changes in Pro Writing Aid, and Scrivener updates automatically. So no more hopping between programs, which is perfect. I'd highly recommend using Pro Writing Aid.
Hello, and welcome to the Rebel Author Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Bianca Blythe. USA Today and best-selling author, Bianca writes fun, frothy, happily ever afters for the wallflowers and spinsters, dukes and rogues who fill her Regency romances. Born in Texas, Bianca spent 5 years in England. She worked in a 15th century castle, though sadly, that didn't actually involve spotting dukes and earls strutting about in hessians. She credits British weather for forcing her into a library, where she discovered her first Julia Quinn novel. She remains deeply grateful for blustery downpours. After meeting her husband in another library, she moved with him to sunny California, though on occasion she still dreams of the English seaside. Scones with clotted cream, chef's kiss, and sheep-filled pastures. For now, she visits them in her books. Hello and welcome.
Hello.
Thank you for coming on the show. We first met in Seville, which was an incredible conference, although maybe should have been in the summer, so it was a little bit warmer, but it was still, Seville is one of the most beautiful cities. And I have been meaning to get you on this show ever since. So thank you. I know we've had a little bit of a roundabout way of getting here, but would you like to tell everyone a little bit about you and your journey with historical romances? Like, how did you get to where you are today?
So I've written over 30 historical romances. I was one of those children who always wanted to be an author. I never had any, you know, when those annoying adults would ask children, you know, what do you want to become? And some other children would be like, I don't know. Why would I know? I always knew. I always knew I wanted to be an author. But when I reached college, I got the impression that that was a completely impossible, impractical career. I think I read somewhere in the New York Review of Books that only 80 people in the US were full-time authors, which seems wild that they were putting out that information.
What?
And I thought, well, there are more brain surgeons than authors then. So, I mean, this is, yeah, New York Times. In the old days, during when everyone did traditional publishing, though, I'm sure there were still pulp books being written, and the number was actually larger than that. So for a while, I wanted to be a museum curator, and eventually I found my way to international education administration, which led me to move to England after graduate school, and I lived there for 5 years, and like we said, I lived in a medieval castle with a moat and a ghost called the Headless Drummer. Fun fact, it used to belong to the Fine family. So you could say I was working for Voldemort's ancestral home.
Oh, wow. As in Ralph Fiennes. That's amazing.
Yes, exactly. Because they lost the castle, you know, a couple centuries ago.
Tell me about the ghost, though. Like, did you ever encounter it or...
I never encountered it. Some say he was just a myth to keep people away from the castle. But he would, yeah, he would ride around with no head and be super scary. So, I mean, who would want to venture to see a castle then?
No, I know. Nobody wants a headless ghost. That would be terrifying.
And yeah, so I would, you know, drive past Martello Towers on my way to work, which were these defenses that were built when everyone was worried that Napoleon would come and invade. So I was thinking Regency, and eventually it inspired me to start writing Regencies.
And now you have 30.
And now I have 30. I have some historical mysteries too. So I've been doing this for a while now.
And so tell me a little bit about like your business structure. Are you fully indie? Are you hybrid? Like, do you have some trad? Like, how have you set up your author business?
I'm mostly indie. I have one series with a historical romance small publisher, actually. So that is a route that some people can take. It's called Dragonblade. Yeah, but mostly indie, and some of my audiobooks are with Audible.
Amazing. Okay, well, we are here to talk about writing historical romance. So I wondered if we could like maybe start with the fundamentals. Like, what is it that makes a historical romance? What do you need to be good at in order to deliver a really satisfying historical romance?
So obviously it mostly just has to be set in the past, but there are particular time periods which are the most popular with readers. So Regency, Victorian, medieval, Western, Scottish historical romance are the most popular time periods. And historical readers like to learn things. So if you can put fun details about the past, they always appreciate that. And historical romance itself is very escapist. They have castles and manor houses and balls. So it's just a really fun genre.
So what kind of, do you have like an example of like the fun details that you, maybe the things that you love to include? Like, I had no idea that I would understand like a historical reader reading a nonfiction book to learn, but like, I had no idea. That makes so much sense. Of course they like to learn like in their fiction books as well. Yeah. So do you have any like fun little thing? Like, where do you focus that kind of learner aspect?
So for example, They really liked French maids were really popular because you seemed very high class if you had a French maid, because French people were so fashionable. So you wanted your maid to be French. And so one of my heroines is pretending to be French. So the hero catches her desperately, trying to, study French, and sort of, he catches her.
That's
So that
hilarious.
was a sort of fun tidbit.
Yeah, I love that. And also that's kind of like a I can't think of the trope name, but it's definitely a trope, like the in disguise, a
Yes.
secret identity trope. I
Yes,
love that you're combining that with the
exactly.
learning as well. That's so cool. How do you do your research? Like, how important is accuracy? How much liberty can you take when you write historical fiction?
I mean, you want everything to have been possible, essentially. So it's not a fantasy. And people, different authors have different beliefs on how much gritty reality they want to include, because obviously things were a bit grittier in those days. So personally, I like to emphasize the story and what would make things fun and entertaining for the reader. So a duke, for instance, probably would not marry a maid. Highly unlikely. But it's possible, technically, and that's what makes it romantic. People do crazy things for love. Like people will, in other stories, right? People will fall in love with vampires and decide that they want to become vampires too. Like that's sort of crazy, but that's what happens in romance novels. And a woman probably would not dress up as a guy and sneak onto a ship bound for the Caribbean to join her brother there so she could do scientific research. But technically, it's possible. So that happened in another one of my books. In another one of my books, the hero actually even dresses up as a woman to pretend to be his non-existent elderly aunt who needs a companion for her journey back to Brighton. So, and then he gets some alone time with the heroine, and they can remove some scandalous paintings in another book. And I try to indicate this on my covers too. They're not necessarily very historically accurate. They're mostly most of the women have bright ball gowns on them, and they could be, from the 1870s or something, that style. So if you really just want the historical accuracy, I would look for a book with a cover where the woman is clearly wearing a Regency dress, so with the higher neckline and maybe a bonnet or something.
Are there any mistakes that you see like newer historical romance writers making?
I mean, I think maybe not really going for it completely. Really, I think it's fine to really go for the fantasy of a place filled with dukes. So a book, just about normal, untitled people is interesting, but it might not fulfill that desire that readers have. And put the title in the book. So if you have a duke, put the duke. Make it clear it's about a duke or an earl, or and hint at the trope as much as possible, like how to capture a duke or can't buy me a duke. And just do some research, read, listen to audiobooks, immerse yourself in the world, and I think everyone can write a fun historical romance.
What I love your passion for it. It makes me smile. Like it makes me excited for it. I am much to my probably listeners' surprise. I have had a love-hate relationship with historical fiction. So I struggle when the historical fiction is slow because I love fast-paced books. And I think naturally, just because the amounts of descriptions and things and because of the types of language, it can feel slow sometimes. But I also don't read sweeping epic fantasy for the same reason. But I dabbled in a little bit of historical fiction in my latest book. Which will come as a huge surprise to all of my listeners. Now, it's not historical fiction. By any means, but it was set a thousand, this part of the story set 1,000 years prior. So I had a go and I just, added little elements and things, but kept apart from the dialogue. So the dialogue I tried to sort of make slightly more archaic than the present time. But what else can writers do sort of at that sentence level to make it really feel authentic and historical? What, yeah, do you have any sort of the at the sentence level type tips?
Right. So I would go through your story maybe after you've written a first draft, for instance, and make sure that the details are really coming to life. So think about, what the table looks like, what the couch looks like, for instance, and see if you can work that in. What would the fabric feel like? Touch is one of
That's such
the
a good
thing that
idea.
Jennifer Lynn Barnes talks about is
Yeah.
just this fun thing that readers really enjoy. So I'll look at a lot of antique stores. So I might Google, desk 1818 and see lots of pictures. And then I might, even go to my reader group and say, which one is your favorite?
Oh,
And they
that's a
can vote
great
on which
idea.
one to put in it to get them involved. Yes.
That's a bloody brilliant idea. I never would have thought of that. And to involve them in the research, that's amazing. So do you like what other kind of research do you do? Do you lot do lots of like visiting stuff, or are you very desk-based in terms of research?
I mean, now I'm in California, which is quite far away from all the fun manor houses. So it is more desk-based. I mean, there are so many wonderful period pictures that you can watch to get an idea. Lots of nice documentaries as well. So I think, I mean, everything is available on the internet so easily. So obviously there are libraries with fantastic resources, or you can even go to the British Library. They have a lot of newspapers from that time period
Oh, that's
if
a
you
good
want to
idea.
really get an idea for what was happening.
Oh, that's such a great idea. I love that. Yeah, I mean, not being a historical writer, I'd never think to do those things, but that makes so much sense because that's also written in the voice of people in that era as well. Okay. So how I'm not sure if I've asked this, but how do you balance that accuracy with the need for creativity? I know you've sort of spoken a little bit about that, but I wondered if you could go into some more depth. Like for you, like what elements do you definitely keep accurate, and what elements, I know you've sort of said like in terms of the story and what's possible, but yeah, I don't know. Are there any sort of setting things that you keep very accurate, or dates, or maybe real life events that happened? I don't know. Like, yeah, what do you feel is important to keep accurate, kind of outside of the story in terms of that?
Yeah, the Regency in particular was a very interesting time because there was a war going on with Bonaparte at that time period. So the place was filled with, a lot of the heroes might be going to war, have just arrived from war, and might be, suffering from some PTSD. So I think it is important to read historical survey books to get an idea for the social issues and concerns that were happening at a particular time. And then also just to get a sense of the issues that would have been important to people at that time period. So for example, most of my heroines are obviously unmarried women who are very young. And in that time, it was so important for them to find a good husband and provider. They might just get one chance to do that if their parents weren't super wealthy, to, just one season. And it would be really devastating if if your parents spent so much money on you to go to London to meet these people, and then you're not even asked to dance or something, and your financial future and your parents' financial future, depends on your ability, to set yourself up. In that way. So, I guess getting the emotions is important.
Yeah, I love that. Do you know, I didn't actually really realize that those seasons, do they call it a season? Like the, yeah, I didn't even realize that was, I just thought that was fiction. I thought, you know, like in, oh, what's the bloody big Julia's Bridgerton? I didn't really realize that that actually there was like a marriage season. That's crazy. Yeah, genuinely thought that was like a fictional thing that people had added to make the historical thing, you know, like gossipy and like drama tension filled. So that, yeah, like, see, I've just learned something even on this podcast. what are the challenges you face in writing historical romance? Like, yeah, what other kind of challenges have you faced over the years? Or, yeah, over the years, what have you faced?
I mean, I don't think there are challenges necessarily that are so difficult to overcome, but obviously do some research is important.
Making sure the research is done. Yeah. Okay, cool. What are some like key elements that people who aren't necessarily like as au fait with reading historical romance, but they want to dabble, maybe they want to write a short story or something. Like, what are some key elements that maybe they don't think about including, but that are actually like really important to making a historical romance work?
So small things like seeing someone's ankle or touching someone's ungloved hand would mean a great deal. So just the closest that, we're more accustomed to speaking with a wide variety of people. And for some people in that time period, that would be more unusual. So to get those emotions going, if you go into, behind a curtain and talk to someone, you probably have a lot of emotions going on that you would not necessarily have at this time period if you were to do that.
How does that work? Because the way that you've described that makes me think of sweet romance. But obviously there are some historical romances that are super hot and spicy. So like, how does that work? How does that get balanced? How does it still feel real? Like having, I mean, I don't know if you write heavy spice or light spice, but how do you do that and make it work?
I write medium spice. Obviously some people will have their will write about widows, for example, who would be more experienced, or maybe they meet someone in a brothel, for example, if you want to be super, super spicy. Obviously very experienced. So it really can be as much as you want to go. Usually, I tend to have very curious heroines, so they'll be like, I know we probably can't be together, but this is my one chance, and I'm so curious, and obviously one thing leads to another, so.
And so, what about like the main tropes for historical romance readers? What are the so? I mean, for me, I don't know whether maybe some of this is like traps across because it's romance, but enemies to lovers is obviously like a huge one. But what are some of the tropes that are really popular in historical romance, but also maybe some of the micro tropes. So not just like the big romance ones, but things that are specific to historical romance than like itself.
So, I mean, there are many more books about wallflowers and spinsters, blue stockings, the sort of ugly duckling type characters, lots of fake engagements and, marriages of convenience, disguises, because this was the time period of spies, obviously.
Oh, that's not obvious to me. That's like me learning stuff. That's completely you, I need you to treat me like I know nothing.
There were spies. There was a war going on for much of the time period. And obviously, when the heroine goes to a ball, you would spend a lot of time describing what the ball, how beautiful it is, because readers really enjoy that. So what does the floor look like? What does the lighting look like? What do the candles smell like? What kind of drapes do they have? You
Oh,
know, so those sorts of things.
and
Yeah.
so I'm assuming that there's also like lots of dinners and feasts. Like, how do you keep coming up with reasons and justifications for balls and feasts and dinners and dances and do's? Because, like, I write fantasy, and I tell you, once I've had one event in a book, I struggle to think of another reason to have another event. So yeah, like, so what is, how do you do that?
I mean, they were having lots of fun events all the time. There was this place called Almix, which was which people, I mean, 200 years later, people are still talking about the horrible food that was served there and how difficult it was to get an invitation and how it was so old-fashioned and men might have to wear breeches instead of, you know, trousers that go all the way to the ankle and which were much more modern. So the hero or heroine could attend one of those events. I have in my books, I have even though I have different series, they're all sort of linked in the same world. So one of the characters is often hosting a ball, and he's such a horrible host, but different, you know, different heroes and heroines and different series will get irritated by him, for example. I think it was a fun period, really.
Oh, I love that. And how do you like handle sensitive topics? Because, you know, it's not like today where, you know, like being gay would have been okay, or, you know, there was still a lot of racism then. Like, how do you handle those sensitive topics, but like within the historical like context? Yeah, I would be interested in that.
So I personally think it is important to have a diverse cast. The hero in my first book had lost his leg and was suffering from pain and guilt, because he inherits the dukedom because his cousin, who was supposed to inherit it, pushed him away in battle and ended up dying. Obviously, pain and guilt ensued. So you can have more sort of serious topics like PTSD. Obviously, as far as I do have characters who are clearly who are clearly gay, and it's not talked about. You know, not you know. For example, the guy who hosts all these bad balls. He's so proud of his son, and his son is, you know, always with these very handsome men, and they all hang out and have a lot of fun. And it's very clear that he would be a completely inappropriate match for any of the heroines. But you know, the guy is so proud of his wonderful, you know, handsome son, and he often sets him up with one of these heroines, and then the heroine inevitably decides that she wants to elope with someone else, and he's always so gracious, like, yes, do that. That's
That's
fine. He's
hilarious.
so wonderful. So I think, yeah, I mean, if you read Agatha Christie, for example, which was written, you know, 100 years ago, it's surprising how many of the characters are, you know, oh, I think they are gay. It's just not said in so plainly, necessarily. In my most recent book, the heroine's two best friends are a lesbian couple living together. And I think not everyone in the story is aware, but she's certainly aware. So that's one way to do it, just to include side characters. Sodomy in that time period was a capital offense, so which is absolutely horrible, but it was very seldom enforced. So it was basically only really enforced for like seamen who were sodomizing young boys, for instance. So England had, you know, Molly houses back then, so they had gay bars
A
where
Molly
you
house. I've
could
never heard that
Molly
term.
House,
What?
yeah, in Brighton, just yeah, basically gay bars where people, you know, have drag queens and everything there. So it was sort of a
That's
wild, yeah, I
amazing. Tell me
know,
more. Give me more
right?
information.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that some readers can think is that the further back in history, the more strict they were morally. But of course, it goes up and down. I mean, I think, like they say, the people in the 20s now are having less intimate relations than our generation. And our generation, right? I think that's statistically, that's like a concern. But our generation was nothing compared to the people in the 60s and 70s who were really going at it and everything. So there are these waves in wildness and everything. So if you did want to write about gay main characters, I think it's completely realistic to give them a happy ending, etc. I mean, there were these Molly houses, and it's just that things would be not talked about necessarily. And because, which is horrible. Like, things are so much better now. You don't want that. But because it's something that wouldn't even occur to people, you could, for instance, move in with your best friend and live happily ever after, and maybe, tell your servants that you don't want them to light the fires in the morning or something because you're a bit eccentric or whatever. Or you hire very sympathetic servants. So there were definitely ways to get the happy endings.
I love that.
Like, my husband is from Iran, and homosexuality is still a capital offense there. Like, you still get killed if for that. I think, yeah, we're not necessarily grateful enough for like our liberal Western values sometimes, because things are really, really terrible in other countries.
I have a lot of readers in the Middle East, and I actually made a mistake with my first book. So on the cover of my first book, it said lesbian fantasy romance, I think. And I had a reader in the Middle East tell me that they wanted a physical copy of my book, but they couldn't buy one because it had the word lesbian on it. So for this new series, I made sure that there were no I just put a steamy vampire fantasy romance novel. So there's no indication. And the quote is what's the word? Non-gendered, if you know what I mean. Like there's one name in there, but you don't see the name of the other character, so you can't tell if it's straight or not. Specifically so that like other readers could buy it. And I know that like I've had sort of debates with other people in the community who put specifically the words lesbian like all over their books and have like women on the front, two women on the front and stuff. And sort of it was quite a friction debate because on the one hand, Out and Proud should be able to promote it, but also, and I get that and that's fine, but I want everybody to be able to access my fiction. But obviously, not having those words on the cover also makes it harder to then target your niche readers. But anyway, that's not really what we're here to talk about. But on the marketing front, how do you market? Because you've got a really successful business. So I wondered if you could talk about some of the things that you do, maybe to really engage your readers. How do you, what are some of the main marketing channels that you're using or that are working for you today?
So my readers are typically older, so a lot of the more traditional marketing venues work fine. I don't have to get onto Snapchat or anything. My readers are on Facebook, so Facebook groups still work for historical romance authors. And otherwise, I'm of the belief. So once you have a more mature catalog, you can take your books wide, and I'm of the belief that the more ways to sell your books, the more that just small amounts of money will really add up into nice ways. So I have a lot of translations. I think historical romance is even more popular in non-English speaking countries
Oh,
than it
wow.
is in, yeah. I mean, because people like England so much, they want to travel there. And I think for English, people, they're used to it.
What's your most popular language?
German is my most popular. But if you go to the top 100 lists in a lot of countries, you'll see that historical romance is actually making the top 100, which it does less often, very rarely in the US Amazon.com store, for instance. So I would recommend doing that, applying for Kobo promotions, Nook promotions, Apple promotions, and building up those, setting up your books in Google Play so that they have promote discounts or things that will make them more appealing to readers.
That's amazing. You mentioned earlier one of the things that you did was about putting up two bits of furniture and kind of using that as a way to engage your readers. Do you have any other like tips or tricks that you do to like really engage your audience like that?
I mean, they love helping me decide on names. So names of,
Oh.
if you have a public house or something in your story, a pub, they think that's really fun to name. Or, you have a maid or you have a minor character. They love giving suggestions.
Do you do that whilst you're outlining, or do you do it when you're drafting?
When I'm drafting,
Okay.
normally, yeah, and I might have a placeholder, obviously, because I want to get the words in. But yeah, they like that. I will sometimes sort of highlight it. I'll have like Fashion Friday or something like that, where I talk about polka dots, and I show them lots of different pictures with polka dots on them, and ask what their opinions are on this, or what is their favorite pink dress of these, selection of pink dresses. So they like those sort of things.
I love that. That's so cool. So, and I suppose you're like tapping into that learner side of them as well, like that you mentioned
Exactly.
earlier. So, do you
Exactly.
do this in a Facebook group? Do you have a new, like, how do you work it with your newsletter? Like, yeah.
I mostly do it in a Facebook group. I feel much, I think it's just easier for me just to post something in a Facebook group than to be aware that I'm sending something to 50, to however many people, and then I get a bit more nervous. So for my newsletter, I send it once a week, and I will, so I normally have a different book on sale each week. And I will have an excerpt from the book, and I will send that out to them on the newsletter. So the newsletter, they can read something, and on Facebook, they can look at, pretty pictures.
Oh, that's so cool. So, do you do those? Like, are they always at the start of the book, or is it like a random scene, or? Yeah, like how do you pick your excerpts? Because I always struggle with that. Like I always just do the first chapter as a sneak peek. I always feel so boring, but like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think first chapter is still good, but you can also
Okay.
do the meet cute as well.
Oh,
It's nice,
brilliant idea. Yeah,
right? So something early is good, but yeah, meet cute or first chapter.
okay, cool. And oh, I was gonna ask something else, and it's literally slipped out of my brain. We were talking about the newsletter. Oh, do you do Shopify? Do you have a Shopify as well, or do you?
I do. So that's, yeah, I mean, that's nice as well. So for Christmas, I could offer them all my Christmas books together, and that was fun.
So how do you structure a launch? Do you focus on Shopify first? Do you push pre-orders there? Do you push them to the wide stores? Like, is your Shopify focused on physical? Is it focused on ebooks, audiobooks? Like, how do you, because I set up Shopify just before Christmas because I had a TikTok boom and it literally exploded physical sales for me. So my Shopify, because my first series is in Kindle Unlimited, this second one is not going in because I want to be wide, but also I wanted something in KU, so I wrote that basically for KU. But my Shopify is more or less physical. This is now the only ebook that's on there. So yeah, how does that work for you? Like, how do you drive traffic? Where do you start with a launch?
I still am old-fashioned and I like launching into KU. Still, I like being able to th offer that to my KU readers. So it's only when the series is complete and it's a bit more tired that I will pull it wide and then we'll add it to Shopify and other retailers. But my books can generally, they can be really read in any order. Like the order I have them in is the ideal order, but if you just want to read about blue stockings, for instance, or you have one trope that you really like, you can do that as well. So I will sometimes have bundles by trope as well.
And so you do like interconnected standalones.
Exactly.
So how does that work with read through? Like, what are the things that you kind of sew in to encourage people through the next books? Like, are most historical romances standalones or are they sequential?
Yeah, I mean most of them can be read in any order, and most of them, I mean, you don't really see books where a series t is about the same couple, so it always switches from book to book. And I will, for example, my first series was called Matchmaking for Wallflowers, which was about a magazine that helped wallflowers find matches. And so even in the books that are not in that series, they will, they'll sometimes be reading a Matchmaking for Wallflowers article, for instance. Or, one of the heroines was an archaeologist. So sometimes they talk about, oh, she's in Italy now or something, and she's just a minor. You don't see her, but you hear about her in other series. And then of course there are some characters where, who are minor, where they will appear in different series as well.
Okay, and like my last question before my ultimate podcast question, how has historical fiction evolved over the years? What are the kind of trends that you've seen wax and wane? What do you kind of see coming down the pipeline?
Yeah, so I mean, historical romance, or specifically Regency romance, has always had a strong humor thread in it. It was really started by a woman called Georgette Heyer, who was a contemporary of Agatha Christie and P.G. Woodhouse. And I see a lot of similarity with her works and, screwball comedies in the 30s, for example. So for a time period, in the 70s and 80s, the books were a bit more serious, and there was more heroes defiling heroines, and then super scandalous, but then I guess the act would feel good, and then the heroine would still be a good girl because she hadn't, et cetera, et cetera. So there is definitely also historical writers who came from that stream and like the more steamy, darker side of historical romance. It looks now that more of the books have that comedic edge to it. There are more fake dating scenarios going in. But really, I mean, if you want to write darker, there's an audience for that as well, too.
Yeah, I think with the rise of like mafia and dark romance in contemporary, that is, yeah, I mean, I'm sure you could find a market for that at the moment, even in historical as well. But then, yeah. Oh, that I suppose I'd be interested in the data to see like the age range of dark romance readers to see if they're like younger or if they're older, like the historical. I mean, I have no idea, but I'd love to know. Okay, well, this is the Rebel Author Podcast. So tell everyone about a time you unleashed your inner rebel.
So, like a lot of people, I did not like high school very much. I thought it was so boring and it wasn't very pretty. It wasn't aesthetically pleasing. There was a lot of asbestos coming from the ceiling in my high school. They were working on it. So I decided not to stay anymore. So I did an exchange. I basically moved to Germany right after I turned 16 and did an exchange year there. And then when I was 17, I moved to Paris and Rome for a year. I was having very good time there and not doing things appropriate for for seniors in high school at that time
Amazing.
period. So I think that's something that I think that's something that I still take with me now. I think people can forget that if they don't like their situation, it's often possible to make changes. So authors today sometimes will move to Mexico, for instance, and there are more countries are offering digital nomad visas for authors. So that was my unconventional high school.
Did you finish high school in Paris then?
No, I had skipped a year. So I've never done fifth grade and never done 12th grade. So I have uneven education.
Oh, wow. Is that because you
I
like did
did.
all the work or?
So I mean, I skipped fifth grade because my parents were living, I was living in Asia with my parents, and then I came back and there was no room in the class. And because my grades had always been really good, they were like, oh, you don't need to do fifth grade. This put you straight into middle school.
Crazy. That's amazing.
Which I mean, I don't recommend. I was not on being the, youngest by 1 year in middle school. I did then. My parents didn't want me to start college when I was younger as well, so they let me go to language schools in Paris and Rome. But like, I was living in like the crack district of Paris. Like, it wasn't, it was sort of shady neighborhood, but it was, absolutely beautiful. I mean, Paris is so beautiful and amazing. And I had a view of the Eiffel Tower from my kitchen window. So yeah, it was great, but somewhat unconventional.
Amazing. I absolutely love that rebellion. I bet there are a lot of stories you could tell me in Seville about that time. Oh, absolutely amazing. I've had a few good nights in Paris as well. Well, tell everyone where they can find out more about you, your books, and anything else you'd like to add.
Yes, you can find me at biancablythebooks.com. And if you're interested in reading, How to Capture a Duke is currently free and available at all retailers. So
Amazing.
thank you
Oh,
for
thank
having
you
me.
so, no, thank you so much for joining me. And I look forward to catching up again in Seville.
Yes.
And of course, a giant thank you to all of the show's listeners and all of the show's patrons. If you would like to get early access to all of the episodes, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/Sasha Black. I'm Sasha Black. You are listening to Bianca Blythe, and this was the Rebel Author Podcast. Next week, I'm joined by the absolutely gorgeous human that is Stephanie Bond, and we are going to be talking all about how to write serial fiction. She self-hosts her serialized fiction, and it is fascinating. She was so interesting to talk to, as it was a topic that I haven't really investigated. So join me next week for that. Don't forget to tune in and subscribe on your podcatcher. And when you have a moment, please leave a review.